20-year-old Cindy Anderson was working towards her future. Raised in a devoted Christian home, Cindy was planning to attend Bible college with her boyfriend and was working as a secretary in a law office in the meantime. Just 10 days before she was set to leave her job, Cindy would vanish from her office under bizarre circumstances. In the weeks leading to her disappearance, Cindy had repeating nightmares of being abducted. Someone was calling her at work and scaring her, and bizarre graffiti had begun appearing on the building across the street, calling out the name Cindy. Witnesses saw Cindy in the office that morning she disappeared, but by 10 a.m., the office was vacant and Cindy was gone. When her bosses arrived for work, they found the office prepared for the day, air conditioner on, radio playing, desks arranged for their daily workload, but Cindy was nowhere to be found. Lacking any major clues or evidence, police were baffled, and despite their sincerest efforts, Cindy's case remains the longest unsolved disappearance in Toledo history. Some 39 years later, there are theories, but none which can be tied up with solid evidence. Could it have been a random abduction? The work of two convicted serial killers? The maintenance man of the building? Or perhaps her own boss, who had ties to an illegal drug operation? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 103, The Vanishing of Cindy Anderson. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine a truly mysterious disappearance. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders, disappearances, and other crimes. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence Podcast. The show is also on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show, as it is a one-man operation, and you'd like to get some Trace Evidence swag, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information, as well as thorough information on all episodes. To submit case suggestions, you can visit the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. As a final note, the contest to win my copy of episode 100 script concluded just a few days ago. At the end of the episode, I'll announce the winner. I want to give a special thanks to everyone who contributed. It really meant a lot to me, and I'm looking forward to mailing out the script. 20-year-old Cindy Anderson went to work and never came home. The circumstances surrounding her disappearance have been nothing short of mystifying. This is episode 103, The Vanishing of Cindy Anderson. Cynthia Jane Anderson was born on February 4th, 1961, some 59 years ago today. Cynthia typically went by the shorthand name Cindy, and so I'll be referring to her as Cindy throughout the episode. Born into what has been described in multiple sources as a fundamentalist Christian family, Cindy has often been described as bright-eyed, polite, sweet, and devoted to her Christian religion and upbringing. Cindy's parents, Michael and Margaret, would have four children in total, giving Cindy two brothers, Mark and James, and a sister, Christine. From all available sources, the Anderson family were tight-knit, spending a lot of their time in church or participating in charitable events. Cindy grew up in Lambertville, a section of Bedford Township, Michigan, at 3030 Springbrook Drive. Lambertville is a small town located in Monroe County, at the southeast corner of the state, with a population of less than 10,000 residents. Springbrook Drive was a quiet little street, shaded by overhanging trees and stopping at the edge of a woods. In the backyard of the Anderson home, there was a playset, swings to enjoy, and a small playhouse, both of which certainly got their mileage out of the children. While today what remains is the decaying remnant of a home, At the time, it was a beautiful location to raise a family, tucked neatly into the calm bud of nature and away from the business of city life, though that was certainly in reach for those who sought it out. Cindy's home was just a 20-minute drive across the state line from Toledo, Ohio, which is listed as her official place of birth. Cindy's father had a job working in HVAC, or heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. While it certainly does not appear that the Andersons had a rich lifestyle, the children were happy with what they had and welcomed into the loving home. Considering her upbringing, Cindy herself spent a lot of time around religious types. Outside of her family, most of her friends came from similar backgrounds and were, in one way or another, connected to the same fundamental beliefs under which she was raised. In an interview with Unsolved Mysteries, when asked about his daughter, Michael replied, quote, "She was a very quiet, obedient type of girl. She never made waves with either myself or her mother, and she had a lot of friends. She was the type of daughter that you just enjoy. I mean, just a beautiful young girl," end quote. In several articles, I've seen her described as kind of naive, perhaps assuming the best of people despite what their intentions might have been. By all accounts, Cindy was a good student who never got into trouble and performed well in her classes. Her upbringing, while strict, was also a guiding light to her in terms of her future. Her faith was strong, and she would later make plans to continue on with a Christian education. Of course, as time passed, Cindy began to step outside the bounds of what may or may not have been considered questionable by her father. The older Cindy got, the more she awakened to herself, and her choices began to spend more time on her presentation, which was something Michael seemed to question. In that same Unsolved Mysteries interview, he made a statement which made a lot of people suspicious of him, though by all accounts, he was nothing more than a dedicated father who believed in a strict adherence to the Bible. The controversial statement from Michael goes as follows, quote, "Just before she disappeared, however, she was becoming like a debutante. She was spending a lot of time on her face and herself, and she skipped breakfast for this reason. And that may be part of the problem," end quote. While some have read into this that Michael may not have approved of his daughter's new interest in her looks, thus meaning there must be something sinister, it comes more across to me as though he was suggesting that accenting her beauty may have made her more eye-catching to a possible predator. Certainly no one was implying that anything that happened to Cindy was of her own doing, in my opinion, but this remains a topic of conversation for those who dig into this case, and so it was pertinent for me to address it. In August of 1981, Cindy was 20 years old. She was out of high school, dating a local boy, and working as a legal secretary for the law office of James Rabbit and Richard Neller. The office was part of the Manhattan Plaza strip mall, just across the state line in Toledo, located at 559 East Manhattan Boulevard. While the job was going well, Cindy had other plans. Just 2 weeks after her disappearance, Cindy was set to go to Bible college alongside her boyfriend. She was excited for the new prospect and looking forward to giving notice and heading off in a new direction. Her relationship was blossoming, and she was going to be embarking on a journey which was founded by her Christian faith. Unfortunately, the 20-year-old would never get the opportunity to move her life in that new direction. While Cindy would vanish under incredibly mystifying circumstances on August 4th, 1981, her experiences and concerns had begun some weeks or even months earlier. First, there were the mysterious phone calls. According to Larry Mullins, a client of one of Cindy's bosses, he was in the office one day when he observed something strange. The phone rang and Cindy answered it. However, a look of concern came over her face and she quickly hung up. Moments later, the phone rang again, and once again, Cindy hung up without saying a word. When Mullins asked Cindy if everything was all right, she brushed off the call, saying that she was fine. But Mullins said he could see fear in her face. Mullins was so concerned about Cindy, according to crime writer Kat Lee of Medium.com, that he actually placed a call to the Toledo police later that day and requested that they do a drive-by of the business to make sure everything was all right. While this was the only time Mullins had witnessed these calls, it was later reported that this was hardly the start, and that Cindy had been receiving disturbing phone calls for months. Cindy, while telling Mullins that she was fine, had genuine concern about the calls. She would frequently arrive at the law office alone in the mornings, letting herself in to prepare for the day. The lawyers themselves often came into work hours later to find their mail sorted, desks arranged for the day, and Cindy answering phones. Due to being there on her own in the mornings, Cindy was worried about the caller or callers potentially showing up one of those mornings and finding her alone. At her request, a panic button was installed beneath her desk. This button, if pressed, would send an alarm to a neighboring business and someone could come to check on her or, if necessary, phone the police. While this button gave Cindy comfort, it would not come into play on the morning she disappeared. Then, there were the dreams. In the year prior to her disappearance and leading up to the time right before it, Cindy had begun having strange and disturbing dreams. According to her family, Cindy was dreaming about being abducted. While details of all the dreams aren't available for analysis, at least one instance of the dream, as described by her sister, involves Cindy allowing an acquaintance inside, at which time the person turned on her and commits an abduction. Cindy's sister Christine told Unsolved Mysteries, quote, "One morning while I was getting ready for work, I overheard Cindy talking to my mother. I do believe that the dreams could have been a premonition of fears that Cindy actually had in her subconscious at the time," end quote. While the dreams may have haunted and disturbed Cindy, they certainly didn't get in the way of the life she was living. I mean, after all, they were just dreams. One last set of incidents which upset Cindy had to do with graffiti. Now, I should note, this particular area is believed by many to have been debunked at this point, so I'm only going to include it for the sake of thoroughness. Robin Warder of the Trail Went Cold podcast does an amazing job dissecting the origins and possible explanations for the graffiti in episode 35 of his podcast, and you should check it out. Essentially, one morning when Cindy arrived for work, she noticed a message which had been spray-painted on a wall which could easily be seen through the windows of her office. The graffiti read, "I love you, Cindy," by GW. At the time, Cindy couldn't think of any GWs she may have known that would have left the graffiti there for her to see it. At one point, the graffiti was painted over, only to return again weeks later, this time painted in bigger letters, though displaying the same message. In the years since, it's become a question of whether or not the graffiti was actually intended for Cindy Anderson, or if this was a bizarre coincidence. A woman on an online forum would later claim that she was actually the Cindy the graffiti was meant for, alleging that she lived in the area at the time and was dating a boy with the initials GW. The location, she claimed, was merely happenstance, as there was a Pizza Hut in view of the graffiti where she often hung out with her boyfriend. This poster wrote, in part, quote, "I am the Cindy the message was written for. GW was Greg Wisniewski, who was the love of my life. He used to write, 'I love you, Cindy, GW, on everything, including overpasses and neighbors' garages. We lived across the street from the Manhattan Boulevard law office where Cindy Anderson worked. We weren't even aware there was a law office there. We hung out there because of the Pizza Hut that was located right there." End quote. I should note, I did look into this. I wasn't able to find an obituary, however, I did find a grave listed for a Gregory J. Wisniewski who perished in a motorcycle accident on September 23, 1983. He was 20 years old at the time, which would have made him 18 at the time Cindy disappeared. An image of Greg on his motorcycle was added to his Find a Grave page, apparently by the same person who made the post about the graffiti. In the caption under the photo, the poster discussed how Greg was the love of her life and that he died in an accident just across the street from where he's now buried, which is Mount Carmel Cemetery in Toledo. While I was able to obtain the identification of the poster, I'm not going to share it in respect for her privacy. While this claim, to the best of my knowledge, has never been fully verified, it does seem like a possible explanation. I mean, some people think it could just be someone looking to insert themselves into the case and dismiss a key detail, but everything I found seems to legitimize it. The fact that this information didn't come out until more than 20 years later, and on a message board at that, is curious, as you'd imagine. This would have been printed in the papers at the time, and the woman could have come forward then, but maybe she didn't want to get her boyfriend in trouble for graffiti. The phone calls, for many, have implied that whatever happened to Cindy may have been conducted by the same person or persons who were making the calls, though no evidence has ever surfaced to make such a connection. There isn't a great deal of information about this case that's out there, but we do know a decent amount about the actual day that Cindy disappeared. It was Tuesday, August 4th, 1981. Cindy skipped breakfast with the family that morning, dressing in a white V-neck dress with pink pinstripes and red piping. She wore cinnamon brown-colored Legs brand pantyhose and beige open-toed sandals with ankle straps, according to the Charlie Project. It's also been reported that she wore a sapphire ring, gold watch, and carried with her her brown purse. At approximately 8:30 a.m., Cindy entered her white 1980s Chevrolet Citation and began the 20-minute commute to work. She had only 10 days left before she'd head off to Bible College. We know that Cindy arrived at work that morning. Multiple witnesses reported seeing her inside of the business. The last believed-to-be-confirmed sighting of Cindy took place at approximately 9:45 a.m. However, when other clients tried to call the law office after 10 a.m., they reported that no one answered the phone and the answering machine was not turned on. There is a report that someone did call and speak to Cindy that morning, but that was sometime before 10 a.m. This seems to suggest that whatever happened to Cindy took place between 9:45 and 10. It would take 2 more hours for anyone to notice that Cindy wasn't where she was supposed to be when attorneys James Rabbit and Jay Feldstein, who worked at the Rabbit and Neller firm, arrived for their day of work. At first, nothing seemed amiss. Cindy's car was in the parking lot, as they'd expect. The front door to the office was locked, which was typical protocol as Cindy was alone in the mornings. However, the first indication that something might be wrong was when the two attorneys noticed that day's mail. Rather than having been taken in by Cindy, it was instead wedged into the handles of the doors, as though the postal worker came by, received no answer, and just left the mail behind. Upon entering the office itself, both Rabbit and Feldstein found the situation eerie. Rabbit would later tell the Toledo Blade, quote, "You knew right away something was wrong," end quote. Cindy wasn't in the office, and while this might not be surprising at certain times of day, it was bizarre that she hadn't left a note. Cindy was in the habit of sticking a note to the front doors when she was running off to do an errand or out to lunch, but on this day, no note was found. Inside of the office, the lights, radio, and air conditioning were all running. The desk had been prepared for the day, as was Cindy's normal behavior, but Cindy herself wasn't there. The phones were active, having not been switched over to the answering service as Cindy would typically do if she were leaving the office. Cindy's purse and car keys were missing from the office, but her car was parked outside. On her desk, there was a novel, propped open to a page as though she'd been in the middle of reading it. Later, investigators would reveal the bizarre detail that the particular page of the novel that had been left open involved the book's protagonist being abducted at knife point. Believing that perhaps Cindy had gone off to run errands, maybe within walking distance, neither attorney thought there was any reason for concern. Rabbit himself would later go to lunch, assuming that Cindy might have gone to lunch and simply forgot to switch the phones over or leave a note. However, when several hours passed without Cindy returning, they called the police. According to reports of the time, the call came in at approximately 2:30 p.m. When police arrived, they had very little to work with. There was no sign of a struggle at the scene, and with the doors having been locked, the assumption was made that whatever had led to Cindy's disappearance had likely taken place outside of the building. Whether Cindy had been walking to somewhere nearby or maybe out to her own car, at which time someone struck, was impossible to tell. All that was known was that Cindy was missing, and there wasn't a single clue as to where to start searching. In yet another strange coincidence connected to the disappearance, on the same morning that Cindy vanished, One of her bosses, Jay Feldstein, was actually in court with her father and brothers representing them. Feldstein was a labor lawyer, and so there was nothing criminal involved in the matter. When later asked about the disappearance, Feldstein told reporters, quote, "We didn't know what to think. Obviously, we felt very sorry for the family for what was a tragic event," end quote. Indeed, the Anderson family struggled to accept the reality of what had happened. How was it possible that Cindy could seemingly vanish into thin air without leaving behind a single trace of what might have happened? While police worked to canvass the area for potential witnesses, it was kind of bizarre that no one had seen anything in what could only be described as a brazen, broad daylight abduction, if indeed that's how things went down. There was some theorizing at the time that while it's entirely possible that Cindy was abducted from the street, there was also the potential that she had willingly gone along with someone unaware of their intentions. Cindy, being concerned about her safety at work, was unlikely to open the doors or step out into the parking lot with a stranger, but she may have been inclined to do so with someone she knew or trusted. At that point, and frankly to this very day, much of the theorizing about what could have happened to Cindy is speculation at best. In the initial hours after Cindy's disappearance, her story and photo were given to the media, and flyers were printed up bearing her image, her last known whereabouts, and the strange circumstances of her disappearance. Cindy's car was examined and searched, though nothing was found to suggest a struggle or that any crime had occurred in the vehicle itself. As a matter of protocol, investigators did arrive at Cindy's home, where she lived with her family, at which time a search for evidence was conducted. According to an article in the Mansfield News Journal, no evidence or suspicious items were found at the home, and the family themselves were quite quickly ruled out as potential suspects. The family were, in fact, shocked by what had occurred and were cooperating with police in every way possible, hoping that they would be able to find Cindy. Sadly, there was nothing. Nothing to work with. Police had to deal with what information was available to them, namely the bizarre phone calls and the graffiti. While we previously discussed the claim that the graffiti had been done by someone addressing a different Cindy, if you'll recall, the graffiti was signed by GW. There was a GW who actually would have access to Cindy, and in fact, was also the final eyewitness who reported seeing her in the office the day of her disappearance. That was the maintenance man for the strip mall, and while police did consider him a person of interest, they never found anything to link him to Cindy's disappearance. I'd love to give you more information about the maintenance man, but there's basically nothing available, not even a name, which I suppose makes sense if he was only ever a person of interest. I've seen his first name listed as George, but that was also in a post which contained a lot of details that were wrong, so I don't put a lot of credence into that name. Cindy's case was basically cold from the day police began investigating. However, approximately 1 month after her disappearance, the Toledo police received a strange set of phone calls. In September, Detective William Adams answered a call from an unidentified woman. During this call, the woman spoke in hushed tones and whispers and alleged that Cindy had been taken captive and was being held in the basement of a white house. I've read that this caller gave a neighborhood, but there were quite a few white houses there, and the information wasn't specific enough for Detective Adams to pursue. When he asked for more information, the caller hung up. She would call back, though, one more time. On the second call, the woman went into more specific details, but was still somewhat vague. While she stayed on the fact that Cindy had been abducted and was being held in the basement of a white home, she went on to explain that there were actually two white houses, side by side, owned by the same family. She explained that the family was out of town, the son was not, and that it was him who was holding Cindy captive. When Detective Adams requested that another officer listen in on the call, the anonymous woman seemed to get spooked and hung up. She never called back, and police were unable to fully investigate and determine exactly who she was talking about. While the call was at first considered a legitimate tip, over the years it's been debated whether or not it was just an elaborate prank. Once again, Cindy's case would grow cold. 3 months after her disappearance, in October of 1981, Toledo police managed to solve a string of sexual assaults and murders when they arrested two brothers, Anthony and Nathaniel Cook. Both brothers were long-haul truck drivers whose crimes were, admittedly, racially driven, with the two African-Americans targeting white victims. Their victims, nine in total, varied in age from as young as 12 and as old as 24. The victims were killed by different methods, some shot, while others were beaten to death using a baseball bat and, in at least one instance, a concrete block. While at least nine murders were committed, it would take nearly 20 years to link the brothers to several of those crimes, being able to do so only with the advanced progress of DNA technology. It is interesting to note that at least one of the victims had worked at a grocery store located in the same strip mall in which Cindy was employed. However, despite being questioned about Cindy's disappearance on several occasions, the Cook brothers denied any involvement. While they may have been potential persons of interest, it does bear noting that in no other case did the Cook brothers attempt to conceal the remains of a victim. And it's commonly believed that had Cindy been one of their victims, her remains would have been located as all the others had been. Sadly, in 1983, the Anderson family suffered a second tragedy when Cindy's mother, Margaret, passed away after a battle with cancer. Margaret never learned the truth of what became of Cindy and took her sadness and loss to the grave. The Andersons were rocked by her death, another harsh blow to an already grief-ridden family. While Margaret died without the truth would remain elusive for everyone. There would not be any new information about Cindy's case for another 12 years, when in 1995, several people were indicted in federal court on multiple charges connected to a drug trafficking ring. What caught the attention of investigators working Cindy's case was the name of one of those men who was indicted, Richard Kneller, one of the attorneys for whom Cindy worked at the time of her disappearance. Kneller was arrested for his connection to Jose Rodriguez Jr., the leader of a major drug operation. In total, Kneller was charged with obstruction of justice, conspiracy to distribute drugs, conducting a continuing criminal enterprise, and four counts of unlawful use of a communications facility. Kneller argued that he was being set up by the feds, saying that he was going to prove his innocence. According to the Dayton Daily News, federal investigators claimed that Kneller had gone from legally representing his clients to actively participating in their drug operations, which revolved around the collection and distribution of both cocaine and heroin. Police began to put the pieces together and believed that Kneller, Rodriguez, or both were responsible for Cindy's disappearance. In the official indictment, it stated, quote, "On August 4th, 1981, Jose C. Rodriguez Jr., Richard Kneller, and other persons known to the grand jury but not indicted herein, abducted and murdered Cynthia Anderson, Richard Kneller's legal secretary, because she had overheard conversations wherein Jose C. Rodriguez Jr. and Richard Kneller had discussed armed robberies and their expanding drug business." End quote. Ultimately, though, neither Rodriguez nor Kneller were directly charged or tried for their alleged involvement in Cindy's disappearance, citing a lack of evidence. In regard to the other charges, Kneller was sentenced to 70 months in prison, which he served. After his release, Kneller attempted to practice law once again, but was ultimately disbarred. Where the information came from suggesting that Cindy had been murdered by Rodriguez, Kneller, and their associates is somewhat difficult. A jailhouse informant told authorities that Cindy had been shot and killed, later buried, in exchange for an early release. He would go on to testify at the trial. While this information certainly drew the attention of investigators, it's important to note that the informant was a career criminal and bank robber who later committed more robberies after his release. He was involved in a scam to break out of prison, which actually worked, and went on to commit further robberies. Whether or not this is a dependable source of information is subject to your discretion. In his claim, the informant said that Cindy's remains were buried, or perhaps submerged, in or around an area known as Perrysburg Pond, though contemporary searches yield no results for this. It appears that the pond was located in Perrysburg, Ohio, and may be part of the Three Meadows Park area. This is an area approximately 17 miles south of where Cindy was last seen, and while authorities did multiple searches of the area and surrounding property, no sign or trace of Cindy was ever found. It was believed there could have been other bodies buried in the area, but I didn't find anything to suggest that any were ever located. When asked about the possible link, Michael Anderson was unsure if Cindy would have known about the drug operation, stating, quote, "If she knew something of Neller's drug dealing, she would have gone to the police. That's just the way she was. Honest, caring," end quote. Indeed, many believe that if Cindy did have knowledge of any drug operation, she would have said something to someone, but no one in her circle ever heard anything about this. While this was considered to be a possible break in the case, nothing ever came of it in connection to Cindy. If indeed she was murdered due to her knowledge of the drug operation or other crimes, it was covered up thoroughly enough that no connections could ever be made, not at least connections that were strong enough to sustain charges, let alone convictions. Sadly, these indictments and their alleged connection to Cindy are the last major news item related to this case. Since the mid-90s, there doesn't appear to be any new developments or leads. Tips come in from time to time, and reportedly the file on Cindy's case is thick and heavy, but there have been no breaks that might provide further insight into her disappearance. It's been 39 years since Cindy Anderson vanished, and according to multiple papers, this is the oldest unsolved disappearance in Toledo to this day. Michael Anderson never gave up on finding his daughter. Over the years, he searched and fought to keep her case in the light, and even hired private investigators to look into the case. Michael continued to live in the family home at 3030 Springbrook Drive. He never changed the phone number, believing that if Cindy did surface alive, he would need to have the same number so she could contact him. He convinced himself during his darkest hours that Cindy could still be alive out there and that someday she might call. Sadly, Michael passed away in January of 2008 at the age of 78, never knowing the truth of what happened to his daughter. To his last days, Cindy was always on his mind, and he never gave up believing that someday she would be found. There are several theories about Cindy's disappearance, which will be discussed in the second half of this episode. Some believe that Cindy may have been abducted and murdered by Jose Rodriguez and Richard Neller. Others argue that the 20-year-old may have been victimized by the maintenance man who had access to the office and who Cindy may have recognized and felt comfortable with. Still yet, there are theories that Cindy may have been abducted by an unknown individual, and to some degree, there has been debate about whether or not she may have orchestrated her own disappearance, perhaps to escape from a strict and religious upbringing, though authorities have said many times that they don't believe that's a likely possibility. If alive today, Cynthia Jane Anderson would be 59 years old. When last seen, Cindy was described as being a white female standing 5 feet 4 inches tall and weighing approximately 115 pounds. Cindy has brown hair and brown eyes. She has a chickenpox scar on her forehead and a 1.5-inch scar on her right knee, shaped like a fish hook. Cindy was last seen wearing a white V-neck dress with pink pinstripes and red piping, cinnamon brown pantyhose, and beige open-toed ankle strap sandals. She was also wearing a sapphire ring and gold watch. Neither Cindy's keys nor her brown purse were ever located. What could Cindy have done with her life in the 39 years since she disappeared? Maybe the head of a major company, a pastor, a mother, an aunt, anything she truly desired to be. Instead, her life was stolen from her, and the truth about her disappearance and fate remain unknown to this day. No parent should have to harbor the pain and grief of losing a child, but to never have a body to bury, to never have answers as to what truly happened, is a horror I can never fully imagine. Maybe someday there will be an answer. Maybe someday the truth will be revealed. Until then, Cindy Anderson remains missing, and the case is very cold. I've been pretty open about my own struggles with depression and anxiety. Recently, I found BetterHelp, an online service that provides you with a counselor who can help you through hard times or just with the general stress of life. For me, BetterHelp has truly been a comforting service to employ. Is there something in your life that prevents you from being happy or stops you from reaching your goals? Sometimes you just need someone to talk to, someone who knows how to help, and that's why BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. Through BetterHelp, you can speak with a professional counselor in a safe and private environment. This can all be done online, making it both comfortable and convenient. With BetterHelp, you can get help on your own schedule at your own pace. You can communicate through secure video, phone sessions, or even chat and texting. There are professional counselors specializing in many different areas such as depression, stress, anxiety, anger, family conflicts, trauma, grief, and more. If for some reason you're unhappy with your counselor, you can change at any time with no additional charge. BetterHelp employs more than 3,000 licensed therapists across all 50 states, but it's not just limited to the United States. BetterHelp is available around the world. You can be matched up with a counselor in less than 24 hours. BetterHelp is available on desktop, mobile web, Android, and iOS. BetterHelp is professional, convenient, and affordable, with financial aid being available to those who qualify. To make BetterHelp even more affordable, Trace Evidence listeners get 10% off their first month using the discount code TRACE. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/trace. Simply fill out a questionnaire so they can assess your needs and match you with a counselor that you'll love. Remember, to save 10% off your first month, visit betterhelp.com/trace. Cindy Anderson's case is one I first became aware of years ago, watching an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. The episode originally aired in 1990, and for the past 30 years, it's always been in the back of my mind. Such a bizarre set of circumstances, such a strange and mystifying disappearance. How does a young woman go to work one morning and vanish without a trace? Cases like this bother me. I mean, all the cases I cover bother me, but particularly those without any major clues. It would seem almost random if not for the phone calls, the concern, the worry on Cindy's mind. What was it she was so afraid of? A random crime due to her availability at the office, or something more that she never shared with anyone? For now, we have no way of knowing, but maybe someday we will. In the absence of evidence, of a resolution, several theories have been suggested over the years. One of those theories has to do with Cindy herself and the possibility that she may have disappeared by her own choice. While I'm not a proponent of that particular theory, I did think it was important to address it as there are some out there who strongly believe it. There are key pieces of information which are often cited: that Cindy grew up in a strict religious home and may have felt the urge to go off and break away; that the phone calls themselves were never heard by anyone else and could possibly have been done to establish an air of a threat, an air of possibility. Some believe the fact that Cindy's book was left open to a page describing an abduction was so on the nose that it had to have been staged, that it was too coincidental to have not been done on purpose. While I admit there are strange circumstances in this case, I don't see anything which would suggest that Cindy would run off on her own. Firstly, according to everyone in Cindy's life, friends, family, boyfriend, she was eager and excited to go off to Bible college. This wasn't something she was forced into. This wasn't something she was fighting against, but on the contrary, something she had fought for. Cindy's boyfriend, by the way, was investigated, and there was no link established between him and her disappearance. He was crushed by the tragedy and worked to try and find the truth himself, though that truth has remained elusive. He never believed that Cindy would have just disappeared on her own. When Cindy's mother passed away 2 years after her disappearance, it's difficult to imagine that if she had gone off on her own, that she wouldn't have surfaced. Indeed, to this day, there's never been any activity on Cindy's social security number. She left behind what has been described as a substantial amount of money in her bank account and made no major withdrawals prior to her disappearance. in terms of the book, I just don't see that as being a major piece of important evidence. If you were planning to run off, why would you purposefully leave a clue behind? I understand people looking for clues in baffling cases, but to me, this is a major stretch of logic. Why would she have left her car behind? Okay, maybe she didn't want to be tracked, but this would imply someone else must have helped her along the way, and could they keep a secret for 39 years? No public transportation seemed to have any sightings of Cindy that day. In fact, in terms of sightings, I could only find one mention of it, and it was about a woman in Texas being spotted. There's never been anything to verify that sighting, and for the most part, it's been accepted as either a mistake or an outright lie. I find it hard to believe that a remotely sheltered and naive person could have not only put together such an elaborate disappearance, but could also remain hidden for all these years. Finally, if you wanted to disappear, why would you do it in the middle of your workday? Seems more logical to do it at a time where you're less likely to be reported missing within hours. To me, the idea that Cindy ran off doesn't make any sense, but I wanted to address it because if I don't, people will ask why. The next theory is that Cindy may have been abducted by a yet unknown individual. That is certainly a possibility. Considering the phone calls, it could have been someone trying to scare Cindy before the actual abduction. Maybe things escalated from phone calls to action. This is difficult to say, but it can't be ruled out. Let's face it, it's a sad fact, but people disappear every day. There are predators out there just looking for prey, and if Cindy became the target of some sick person who was infatuated with her for one reason or another, it isn't hard to imagine the lengths that person would go to capture her. What's truly strange is how this happened in broad daylight in a busy city. I'm sure that's happened before and will happen again, but why was Cindy the target? Well, there's a possibility it wasn't targeted and was instead completely random. You would think someone who specifically targeted Cindy would know her work schedule and thus would assume she'd be in the office that morning. Now, I don't know if Cindy left the office at the same time every day for one reason or another, but it seems strange to me that this could be the case. She apparently got to work around 9 a.m., so why would she be leaving an hour later? Not to mention, she did none of the things she would usually do if she was leaving. No note, phones not placed on hold, nothing. It's my understanding that the doors remain locked and that Cindy actually had to buzz someone into the building. Now, it's possible that someone knocked on the door and claimed to be a client or needed a lawyer, and when Cindy opened the doors, they grabbed her or maybe used a weapon to get her to go along. Sure, but it seems strange to me that that same person would have allowed her to take her purse and keys with her. It seems more likely that if Cindy was grabbed, it happened outside of the office. If Cindy left the office for some reason, to get something from her car, to go to a nearby store, whatever, someone could have grabbed her and made off with her. I find it hard to believe it could have been a struggling snatch and grab, so the presence of a weapon to keep her under control does seem to make more sense. We know she looked for the good in people and may have been naive. Someone could have come along and pretended to be looking for help, though I still find it odd that she wouldn't have left something behind to indicate that she was leaving for a period of time, let alone that someone so concerned about her safety and dreaming of abductions would have just gone off with a stranger. Unless, of course, this unknown individual was not in fact random, but someone Cindy may have known and trusted. There's an angle here which hasn't been explored very much, perhaps due in part to the total lack of evidence. However, it seems more likely to me, rather than this being random, that someone Cindy knew could certainly have convinced her to leave the building that day. Maybe a friend or an acquaintance, knocking on the glass saying, "Hey, want to grab breakfast?" or whatever possible reason. Cindy grabs her purse and her keys, walks out, the door's locked behind her, she gets into a car. She has no reason to be worried, but by the time this person begins driving elsewhere, taking her in a direction she didn't agree to go, it's already too late. Especially if this person was brandishing a weapon or trying to convince her that he or she needed help with something. Sadly, both of these angles are possible. Cindy was going to be leaving for Bible college, and maybe somebody just didn't want to see her go. One potential person who could have been involved, someone Cindy may have known and trusted, was the maintenance man himself. We don't know a lot about this man. I know that he passed away several years ago, that he was considered a person of interest, and that he worked in the strip mall, had keys to the office, and therefore had access to Cindy. Imagine, on some mornings or afternoons, Cindy must have seen him, been aware of him. Maybe she waved through the glass when he went by. Maybe they chatted from time to time. She was a polite, sweet, and caring person, so it isn't outside of the realm of possibility to imagine she could have had a rapport with this man. I don't so much put weight into the idea that his initials were GW, and so he may have been responsible for the graffiti. I addressed that pretty thoroughly, but it is a curious coincidence, if nothing else. Some would say there are no coincidences. Others would say that truth can be stranger than fiction. It's hard to analyze this theory, so we've just got to work with what we know. The maintenance man knew the area, had access, and may have known Cindy. He easily could have locked the doors to the office after grabbing her. He may have been able to convince her to come outside for one reason or another. While there isn't much we can do with this person of interest, it's important to note that the police certainly felt that he could have played a role in Cindy's disappearance. While they never commented about him very much publicly, he was a person of interest and remained so until the day he died. To me, that suggests at a minimum that he must have said something or done something to make police question his involvement. Maybe it was just a hunch, maybe just a feeling. I don't know, but I can't imagine they invested a lot of time and energy into someone who had a solid alibi, clean record, or gave no indications of possibly being involved. I wish I could say more about this potential suspect, but there's really not much to say. All I know is the last time I dismissed someone who was in the area and claimed to be a witness, it turned out to be the guy they ultimately believed murdered Arliss Perry. Before moving on to Rodriguez and Neller, I did want to take a moment to address the Cook brothers. I basically said during the episode that they seemed like unlikely candidates for being involved, but you can't really rule them out considering the crimes they committed. It's not like they were hugely forthcoming about their murders, since it took years to link them to some through DNA. So sure, they could have been involved. It does fit their MO to a degree. What perhaps makes me think they weren't involved is their manner of disposing of victims. They didn't bury them. They didn't try to hide them. They basically left them where they were or dumped them somewhere else. Now, it's entirely possible that they dumped Cindy somewhere else and she simply wasn't found, but what are the odds of that? Maybe they kept seeing all of their murder victims showing up on the news and they decided they needed to start hiding the bodies, but that would mean there's probably more victims out there than just Cindy if indeed they were involved in her disappearance. The Cook brothers, while sick and twisted individuals, seemed more focused on the crimes they committed than actually going out of their way to cover them up. They were truck drivers, so it's certainly possible they could have taken victims out of state and disposed of them elsewhere, though why they would only do that to some and not others is an answer I'm not in possession of. Cindy is listed in NamUs, and to this day there have been 17 unidentified victims considered as possibilities and then ruled out. So yeah, it's possible she could be a Jane Doe in another state, or even in Ohio itself, or that she was never found at all. But again, the Cook brothers honestly seemed too dumb and invested in their crimes to have given much consideration to the manner in which they disposed of someone. Also, it would have had to have been perfect timing. It's not like Cindy knew them and would have let them into the business, nor would she agree to go with them. They'd had to have just stumbled upon her. So, that leads us to the final theory, that one of Cindy's bosses, Richard Neller, and his drug operation partners could have killed Cindy due to her overhearing something about their business. This particular theory has its pros and cons as far as I'm concerned. We know that Neller was involved with these illegal operations, and it's certainly possible that some discussion of them took place in the office. I'd imagine that these would be behind closed doors, and not the kind that Cindy would have been able to just walk in on. However, it's possible she could have heard something, or maybe they believe she heard something. Drug operations are usually pretty brutal when it comes to any potential witnesses or people that they believe could get them arrested. Of course, Cindy was on her way out. She was going off to Bible college. She was leaving the law office, and from everything we know, she never once mentioned any illegal activity going on in that office. She didn't tell friends, family, or authorities. I find it hard to believe that if she knew something was going on, that she'd keep going to work every day. She'd have to have known it was dangerous. She'd have to have been concerned about it. Not to mention, this possibility doesn't seem to link to the phone calls. I mean, I suppose the calls could have been from someone in the operation, but we have no way of knowing what was said on any of those calls. You'd imagine if they were threats of violence as opposed to, say, obscene calls, Cindy would have given the details to someone. If Kneller was involved, I imagine it would have had to have been under those circumstances that he thought Cindy heard something or he knew she did. Then again, this is a lawyer who was involved in a drug operation and other illegal acts that, while criminal, weren't violent in nature. It's not hard for me to imagine a lawyer getting pulled into the illegal activities of a client, but it is difficult for me to imagine that the guy would then be involved in a murder and help cover up that murder. Not to mention, if you wanted to abduct and kill an employee, would you really do it from your own business? Now, on the other hand, Kneller certainly could have convinced Cindy to walk out of the office that day. He could have arranged for her to be abducted. Maybe he thought they were just going to put a scare into her and things went south. Or maybe he knew all along. Maybe he was threatened if he didn't do something. It's really all speculative. But what if Kneller wasn't involved? What if it was Rodriguez Jr. and some associates without Kneller's notice? I imagine he could have put two and two together later, but at the time he could have been uninformed. If Cindy did hear something, he could have told Rodriguez that she wouldn't talk, and Rodriguez could have pretended that he believed him. Then again, considering they were dealing in coke and heroin, it isn't hard to imagine they could have all been tuned up and decided to commit the crime. Usually, when something like this happens, especially considering the location she disappeared from, you look at people close to her. It's hard for me to rule this theory out. At the same time, this theory comes from the mouth of a career criminal informant who worked out a deal for early release based on his story. He apparently gave police a location to search, but they never found anything, which makes me question his story more. Beyond that, are we to believe that Kneller, Rodriguez, or someone else connected to the crime just decided to tell a random prisoner or cellmate all about it before they'd even gone to trial? That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, I know prisoners talk and try to make themselves tougher than they are, but this is difficult to swallow. Had this information come from someone in the operation itself, then I'd find it a little more believable. Out of all the theories we've got, the two that seem most likely to me are either the maintenance man or Kneller and company. However, there's pretty much no evidence to link anyone to this crime. While it's a horrible situation, there's very little to work with. And I know I've said that a lot, but it's so frustrating to have basically no evidence. When that's the situation, you're relegated to basically guesswork and hypotheses. I'd like to imagine that if Kneller and company had been involved in this crime, the police would have pressed him hard for a confession. Hell, I think someone in Kneller's position, if he had knowledge of the crime, would have gladly given up that information for reduced charges and a lighter sentence. But he didn't. He was indicted, he was sentenced, and he served his time, which resulted in him being disbarred. He never admitted any connection. He didn't testify against anyone else about Cindy, and police never got a story out of him about it. As one final note about Kneller, would he or Rodriguez have really gone through the trouble to leave that book page open about an abduction just for kicks? Just as a note in relation to the book itself, it seems unlikely to me that someone would have thumbed through it looking for a passage to leave open. Maybe if they'd read the book before, they'd have known it was there, but this book has frequently been described as a romance novel, and while it's possible these guys could have previously read it, it seems less than probable. I think ultimately the book itself is a red herring in this case. For 39 years, the fate of Cindy Anderson has remained unknown. Her case, basically cold from the start, has had few moments of growing warm, but has never truly heated up. Despite their efforts, the Toledo police have not been able to crack this case, nor have they been able to make any solid connections to a potential suspect or person of interest. It's a horrible story, a terrible tragedy, and a disappearance which hangs like a cloud over the city. No one in the Toledo police have forgotten about Cindy, nor have they given up on her case. But with a lack of tips and a lack of evidence, her file remains full of questions with few answers. Unless new evidence is found, someone confesses, or Cindy herself is located, this case will remain open, unsolved, and extremely cold. If you're looking for more information about the vanishing of Cindy Anderson, there are some news articles available. Unsolved Mysteries did a segment on the case, and episode 35 of The Trail Went Cold digs into it as well. You can look up Cindy's case on the Charlie Project, and she does have a nameless page addressed at MP10491. If you have any information about the vanishing of Cindy Anderson, please contact the Toledo Police Department at 419-245-3151 or 419-245-3111. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, tag me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. The contest for episode 100 has officially ended, and with more than 200 entries, I'm really grateful for everyone who participated. It's time now to reveal the winner. The winner of my copy of episode 100 script is Ashley Pellegrino. Congratulations, Ashley. I'll be contacting you soon to get shipping information from you. Everyone else who participated, I truly appreciate your participation in helping spread awareness about episodes of Trace Evidence, and I'll try to run another contest sometime soon if you'd be interested in my copy of a script of any other episodes that I work on. One final note. Are you planning to attend CrimeCon this year in Orlando? If you are and you haven't yet purchased your ticket, you can use the promo code TRACE2020 to get 10% off today. I'm going to be there on Podcast Row representing Trace Evidence, and I would love to see you there. So, when purchasing your tickets, use promo code TRACE2020, and I look forward to seeing you. It's time to thank our Patreon producers. Special shout out to Tara Doble, Alicia Lorraine, Angie Dodd, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Brett Eady, Kevin Bonham, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Gerard Lopez Barbosa, Jessica, Laura Dickinson, Linda Halcrow, Nick Mohar Schurz, Megan Cotter, Quinn McBreen, Randy Weiland, Robbie Blue, Tom Archer, and Tracy Woods. If you think your name should be on this list, but it's not, please contact me, as Patreon is often terrible at organizing the lists properly. That's going to do it for this episode. I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.